In fact, a fraction of what is routinely done today in my specialty I made up," Locke said with a grin. "That is because children often have such unique problems with their hearts that there is little precedent. But," Locke continued, "you simply have to do something. The big problem is that most people assume that once it's made up, it's actually real, especially the people who make it up themselves. Then they think it came straight from God. Couldn't the admission that a certain practice is made up paralyze a clinician?" I asked. "Not everyone in medicine can be constantly making calculations about the value of the information. You'd go crazy. But if you are in a subspecialty field, as you train, you not only need to know what people know, but how they know it. You have to regularly question everything and everyone." Ironically, James Locke learned the seminal lesson about the care of children with malformed hearts from the case of a child born with a normal one. Holly Clark was a 4-year-old in Minnesota with dark brown eyes and long brown braids. One spring morning she told her mother that she didn't feel good. Mrs. Clark felt her forehead and then reached for a thermometer. Holly's temperature was 100.5 degrees Fahrenheit. A virus was going through the nursery school class. Mrs. Clark gave Holly some liquid Tylenol for her fever and put her to bed. By the next day she was breathing in short, forced gasps, and her skin had a dusky color. Mrs. Clark drove Holly to the ER at a local hospital affiliated with the University of Minnesota Medical School. The ER doctor found that when Holly took in a deep breath, her blood pressure fell sharply. A chest X-ray showed that the normal contours of her heart were distorted. Instead of the usual boot shape, the heart had a globular appearance, like a water balloon suspended in the chest. Holly was never seriously ill before, only the occasional runny nose or upset stomach. And as far as Mrs. Clark knew, her daughter's heart and lungs always had been normal. The doctor performed an EKG that showed reduced electrical voltage. "It's a textbook diagnosis," he told Mrs. Clark. "Cardiac tamponade." Cardiac tamponade means that fluid had accumulated around the heart and was compressing it. This can occur as a result of swelling of the tissue from a viral infection. The buildup of fluid grips the heart like a fist and prevents much blood from entering the organ or exiting to the body. Holly could go into shock if the fluid was not removed. An attending pediatric cardiologist was called to the ER. He explained to Holly's mother how he would drain the fluid from around the heart. First, he would use a large bore needle to penetrate the pericardium, the fibrous sac that surrounds the heart. Then he would employ a syringe to draw off the liquid. Once the fluid was drained from under the pericardium, the heart would pump unhindered, and Holly's circulation would be restored. "Where do you stick the needle?" Locke asked. We were sitting in his office, and he was telling me about this case from his training some 30 years earlier. I quickly replied, "Subxiphoid," meaning that the needle was inserted below the xiphoid, the tail of cartilage that extends from the lower end of the breastbone. And, I continued, "after inserting the needle below the xiphoid, you angle it up toward the right collarbone and advance until you penetrate the pericardium." As the young James Locke stood next to the attending cardiologist, learning the procedure, that was exactly what the cardiologist said would be done. The senior doctor first palpated the child's breastbone, and then ran his fingertips down to the pliant cartilage that forms the xiphoid. At the lower tip of the xiphoid, he cleaned the skin with an antiseptic and applied a local anesthetic. Then he took the syringe with a large bore needle attached to an EKG lead. He punctured the skin, and a halo of blood formed around the needle's shaft. He moved the needle up under the xiphoid, advancing slowly until he felt the tip meet the firm fibrous sac, the pericardium. The doctor waited a moment and then pushed deeper. The sac gave way. "Why do you stick the needle under the xiphoid?" Locke asked. I paused. "Because that was how my teachers taught me in my training." "And why do you think your teachers taught you the way they did?" Locke asked. "Because that's how they were taught." When the cardiologist pulled back on the plunger of the syringe, he met resistance. Straw-colored fluid should have come rushing out. But instead, the plunger would not budge. "Sometimes," the cardiologist said to Locke, "the fluid beneath the pericardium is so thick with protein and inflammatory debris that it is difficult to drain even through a large-bore needle." The cardiologist cautiously moved the needle a few millimeters deeper, thinking he might reach a less thick collection of fluid. He pulled back on the syringe. Bright red blood gushed in. The cardiologist froze, the needle still in Holly's chest. "She almost died," Locke recounted. "The needle went right into her heart muscle. It was a catastrophe. She needed emergency surgery." Although the cardiologist had advanced the needle only a short distance, it turned out that there was almost no fluid in that area beneath the pericardium. Nearly all of the fluid had accumulated off to the side. Locke was shaken by the event. He questioned everyone he could about why the procedure was done this way, and he received the same answer that I had given him, that it was handed down by mentors. "I looked at the medical literature and dug back into the 1920s, Locke told me. It turned out that one of the earliest reports on how to drain fluid came from a woman physician. Her first attempt was done by sticking the needle through the back, and was a success. At the time, Locke continued, the only way to know whether there was fluid was by percussing the heart, tapping one's fingers over the chest and listening to the dull sound from fluid that contrasted with the high notes from air that filled the lungs. After the successful report of drainage via the back in the 1920s, the approach was widely adopted. But complications soon ensued. The coronary arteries run over the surface of the heart muscle, and sticking a needle through the back sometimes punctured those vessels. So cardiologists looked for the part of the heart where you have the smallest chance of meeting a coronary artery, Locke explained, and that turned out to be under the xiphoid. Locke returned to the lesson of Holly Clark. "Now I teach my trainees not to go by rote under the xiphoid. We should always go where the fluid is. We follow Sutton's Law." Sutton's Law is named after the 1930s Brooklyn bank robber Willie Sutton, who robbed bank after bank and accumulated a fortune before he was captured. When Sutton was brought into court, the judge asked him why he robbed banks. "Because that's where the money is," he answered. The tale is probably apocryphal. The reply attributed to Sutton likely was made up by a reporter at the trial to color his story. But the term Sutton's Law has stuck. Locke helped change the way the procedure is done. Now an ultrasound is always performed first, to visualize the fluid around the heart, and a small needle is inserted under ultrasound guidance. The heart is a pump with four chambers, two on the right and two on the left. Each upper chamber is called an atrium, from the Latin denoting an entry, and each lower chamber a ventricle, also from Latin for belly, since it is somewhat oval in shape. Blood depleted of oxygen returns from the body to the right atrium. It moves from this chamber into the right ventricle. The right ventricle pumps the blood out through the pulmonary valve into the pulmonary artery to the lungs. In the lungs, the blood is recharged with fresh oxygen, and waste products like carbon dioxide are released. The refreshed blood returns from the lungs via the pulmonary veins to the left atrium. The valve that separates the left atrium from the left ventricle reminded early anatomists of a bishop's mitre. So they named it the mitral valve. Once the blood crosses the mitral valve, it enters the left ventricle. The left ventricle is much thicker than the right ventricle. Its thick muscle contracts and generates high pressure to pump the blood across the aortic valve into the aorta, the large artery that carries it to all parts of the body. One of the most common congenital abnormalities of the heart is a hole between the two upper chambers, between the right atrium and the left atrium. Since the pressure in the left side of the heart is higher than in the right, blood will flow from the left atrium through the hole into the right atrium. This aberrant blood flow is called a shunt, and can overload the right side of the heart, leading to heart failure and other complications. Locke told me that doctors send children for surgery to close these holes if there is a 2-to-1 shunt, meaning that twice as much blood flows through the right side of the heart than the left. "Do you know where that 2-to-1 number came from?" Locke asked. I imagined it was from careful clinical studies of children with the hole. You would think so, but you'd be wrong. At a medical meeting in the 1960s, a pediatrician presented the question, "When should the hole be closed?" to a group of cardiologists. There was a heated debate about how much shunting required a surgical fix. So the meeting organizers, out of desperation, took a vote. Some voted for a lower number, some for a higher number. The median ended up being 2-to-1. This was published in the American Journal of Cardiology. So now all textbooks have as the truth that you should close a hole when the shunt is 2-to-1. But, Locke continued, children can have a 2-to-1 shunt and still have a good chance of being healthy and never needing any specific treatment. Many children with 2-to-1 shunts undergo surgery and probably don't need the operation. Why are we still making it up? Because you can't do the clinical study to really find out. You would have to randomize 500 kids to closure versus non-closure. It would take 40 years to do it. And there are ethical and moral constraints to such a study. You can't do the kinds of studies in human beings that you can do in cars. You can't crash test a human being, Locke said. So you have to deduce answers from the data on hand, limited though such data may be. In Locke's specialty, a keen spatial sense is essential to deducing those answers. You need to be able to look at a single plane image and reconstruct it in three dimensions almost instantaneously. For example, during a cardiac catheterization, the cardiologist manipulates the catheter through the child's blood vessels and into his heart. The catheter appears as a thin white line on a flat monitor screen next to the table. It can be difficult in such a two-dimensional projection to know the catheter's position. The combination of how your hand moves and what the image looks like will tell you whether the catheter is pointed toward you or away. I can tell you where it is even if my hand is off the catheter. Knowing in which direction you are going shouldn't be something you need to think about. Locke spoke about physical genius, the kind of genius displayed by stellar athletes who can anticipate exactly where the ball is headed. Growing up, Locke idolized baseball players who could connect with a breaking curve ball and hit it out of the park. He worshipped wide receivers who could run without looking back and place themselves within reach of a spiraling football. You need to process what you see very quickly and act on the information in a split second, Locke said, because the heart is beating. It's not like you can stop the child's heart and ponder. Once you are inside of a kid's heart with a catheter, you have an enormous amount you have to accomplish. And there is a great deal of risk if what you do is not done quickly and well. Recent studies contradict the popular notion that doctors who perform challenging procedures, like Locke, are born with good hands, that they have innate talent in manual dexterity. Of course, if you are a complete klutz, manipulating instruments in a child's heart would not be your ideal career path. But this research on physician performance of procedures shows that visual-spatial ability, meaning the capacity to see in your mind the contours of the blood vessel or the organ, rather than the nimbleness of your fingers, is paramount. Although at the beginning of training there are differences among doctors in their visual-spatial ability, as Jeffrey Norman, a researcher at McMaster University in Ontario, has emphasized, this ability can be enhanced to the expert level by repeated practice and regular feedback about success and error in technique. Tom and Helen O'Connell had eagerly anticipated the birth of their first child. Tom was a gym teacher in a local Catholic high school, and Helen was an accountant. Every evening they practiced breathing techniques from their birthing class. Tom joked that being a coach was natural for him. They knew from the ultrasound that it was a boy, and decorated the baby's room with Red Sox pennants and a New England Patriots football. Helen's labor took 8 hours and went smoothly until the baby emerged, blue and gasping. The obstetrician and nurse quickly removed a thick brown liquid from his mouth. If there is distress during the birth, the infant defecates this liquid fetal stool, called meconium, and breathes it in during the struggle. Even after they aspirated the meconium, the kid was extremely blue, Locke told me. Baby O'Connell was rushed to the cardiac ICU. But, despite every measure, the doctors were unable to get enough oxygen into his system. He had a cardiac arrest within the first 30 minutes of life, so they crashed onto ECMO, Locke recounted. Again, ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, the special heart-lung machine used only in the most dire circumstances. Shira Stein was headed for ECMO until she rallied. But unlike in Shira's case, there was no surprise turnaround. A large catheter was placed into baby O'Connell's neck. The venous blood from his body, depleted of oxygen, would ordinarily go to the right side of the heart and be pumped to the lungs where it receives oxygen. But instead, the spent blood entered the ECMO machine. Baby O'Connell's depleted blood passed over a broad porous membrane that allows the release of toxic wastes and carbon dioxide and the entry of much-needed oxygen. A pump moved his freshly oxygenated blood into a second catheter in his neck. This entered his aorta, and from his aorta, the blood reached the tissues of his body. ECMO can have dangerous side effects. The large catheters inserted in the baby's neck can provide a fertile field for infection, resulting in fatal sepsis. Friction from the pump and at the membrane surface can destroy fragile blood platelets, predisposing him to life-threatening hemorrhage. It was urgent to decipher his problem and get him off ECMO. But each time the doctors tried to detach baby O'Connell from ECMO and give him oxygen via a respirator, they failed. Something was seriously wrong, but no one could pinpoint the precise problem. In normal circulation, as we've seen, spent blood returns from the tissues and enters the right atrium, which pumps it into the right ventricle. The right ventricle then pumps the blood through the pulmonary arteries to the lungs, where fresh oxygen enters and toxic carbon dioxide is released. The newly oxygenated blood returns from the lungs via the pulmonary veins to the left atrium and then the left ventricle. The left ventricle pumps the oxygen-rich blood into the aorta and then through the arteries to the body. In a newborn, one cause of being very blue, indicating scant oxygen in the tissues, Locke explained, is that the pulmonary veins are connected incorrectly. They go somewhere other than the left atrium, or they're blocked for some reason. In such cases, the oxygen-rich blood leaving the lungs can't enter the left heart and be pumped to the body. there is a backup in the system. You get a blue child. Fluid seeps into his lungs. Pulmonary edema. Baby O'Connell was taken to the cardiac lab for further study. The lab has bright overhead lights, a movable table, a fluoroscope to obtain real-time X-rays. Catheters were threaded into his heart and vessels, and computerized monitors displayed their pressures. Dye was injected into the pulmonary artery. The dye should have passed through the artery into his lungs, then out via the pulmonary veins and entered the left atrium. "Nothing is going through to the heart," Locke observed. Somewhere there was an obstruction. A catheter with a tiny balloon at its end was snaked into the pulmonary artery and inflated. The balloon opened up the artery. Again, dye was injected. This time, the dye went through the pulmonary artery into the lungs and entered the pulmonary veins. An image appeared on the fluoroscopic screen that resembled the trunks of a tree with tapering branches. But the tree and its branches seemed suspended in the chest. "The pulmonary veins don't go anywhere," Locke said. "They don't connect to the left heart. They just stop." For a long moment, there was silence. None of the doctors or nurses could figure out the path of Baby O'Connell's vessels. Locke moved his head back and forth in its radar sweep. Then he stopped. He pointed to a trickle of dye that had somehow made its way into the inferior vena cava, the large vessel that brings blood from the lower part of the body into the right heart. It made no sense. Why would a whiff of dye injected into the arteries of the lungs end up in the belly? "That's what he is trying to live on before he dies," Locke said, referring to the trickle. Again, silence filled the room. It seemed the baby would be lost. "What doesn't belong here?" Locke asked himself. When he confronts an unknown, he thinks out loud. He manipulated the computer keyboard and called up the stored images onto the screen from the previous injections of dye. He flashed each in succession. No new clues. Then, with a rapid jerk of his arm, he pointed to a thin white line over the right side of the baby's chest. "What's that?" he demanded. No one on the team had any idea. Locke traced the mysterious line on the screen, moving backward from the baby's chest down to a tangle of images that represented the tubes and catheters that the doctors had inserted. "It's the umbilical catheter in the umbilical vein," Locke yelled out. A catheter had been placed in the umbilical vessel that originally connected the mother to the fetus. "But where is that line ending now?" Locke asked. After a few seconds of intense concentration, he announced, "It's in the pulmonary vein." A vessel in the abdomen was aberrantly connected to a vessel in the chest. Locke and his colleagues had never encountered a case like this. Using the catheter in the umbilical vessel as a thread, he began to unravel the bizarre connections of Baby O'Connell's anatomy. The umbilical vein connected to the large portal vein in the child's belly, and the portal vein somehow was connected to the pulmonary vein in the chest. "When you have never seen anything before," Locke said to the team, "it becomes an opportunity to do something no one has ever done. Let's try to open up the pulmonary veins using the umbilical catheter." Locke took a long guide wire that resembled a straightened coat hanger. He threaded the wire through the umbilical catheter, up through the abdomen, into the chest and the pulmonary vein. Following this wire, Locke inserted a catheter with a balloon on its end. He inflated the balloon and expanded the pulmonary vein. Then he injected dye. The dye flowed from the pulmonary vein in the chest into the portal vein in the belly and then began to slowly work its way back up into the baby's chest and into his heart. "Why is it still only a slow trickle?" Locke asked. "There must be a second obstruction." Locke located another vessel branching off the portal vein. He expanded this second vessel with a balloon catheter and threaded two metal stent devices and wedged them into the opening. He paused and moved a catheter into the pulmonary artery of the lungs and injected dye. "Look at the blood blasting out," he exclaimed. Now blood flowed down from the pulmonary vein in the chest to the portal vein in the abdomen, then up via the stented vessel into the left side of the heart. Locke had created a path to get oxygen-rich blood from the lungs to the left side of the heart and out to the baby's tissues. Baby O'Connell spent 3 more days on ECMO as his body gradually adapted to a jury-rigged circulation. Then the doctors placed him on a respirator. His oxygen levels held. A few days later, I went to visit Baby O'Connell in the cardiac ICU with Jim Locke. The O'Connells warmly greeted him. Locke reviewed with them the procedures he had performed and emphasized they were temporary measures, but effective for now. Soon Baby O'Connell would undergo surgery to fully repair his circulation. As we walked out of the ICU, I asked Locke how he thinks through these kinds of conundrums. "When a case first arrives," he told me, "I don't want to hear anyone else's diagnosis. I look at the primary data." He avoids all biases or preconceptions. He tries to identify the key clinical features, pattern recognition, and frame the situation himself. In this instance, the shadow just didn't belong there, he said, referring to the white line of the umbilical catheter. While everyone was concentrating on what he termed the main event, the blocked pulmonary vessels, he said he was able to see the entire picture at once, integrating each component into a coherent whole. And when one piece does not fit, he seizes on it as the key to unlock the mystery. "It's like that game, Where's Waldo?" he said. The surgery was a success. Baby O'Connell's pulmonary vein was attached to the back wall of his left atrium, so there was a robust flow of oxygen-rich blood from the lungs to the left heart, which pumped it out to the aorta. He'll be carefully monitored, and he may need further surgery as he grows, but there was no reason, Locke said, that he couldn't lead a normal life. A week after we saw Baby O'Connell, I asked Locke about the times when his judgment was off target. "The mistakes that I remember," he began, and then stopped in mid-sentence. I was struck by his pause. Studies show that most physicians are unaware of their cognitive errors. Locke's phrasing acknowledged this. There likely were instances where his judgment was wrong, but he was yet to learn of them. Then he picked up the thread of his thoughts. "All my mistakes have the same thing in common." Locke took a blank sheet of paper and began to rapidly sketch the outlines of the heart, its chambers and valves. "There was a disorder called common AV canal," he said, "where the wall between the left and right sides of the heart does not fully form. This most often occurs in children with Down syndrome. The central part of the heart is missing, and this can include the lower wall between the atria, part of the mitral valve and part of the tricuspid valve, and the upper wall between the ventricles. All don't form." "Some of these children also have aortic stenosis," Locke explained, "meaning partial closure of the aortic valve, or coarctation of the aorta, meaning that the large vessel is narrowed. When this happens, the left ventricle can be very small." The question that faced pediatric cardiologists was whether a baby's left ventricle was large enough for the child to undergo repair of the malformed wall and survive the procedure. When Locke was in his 30s, he reasoned that the decision to operate or not should be based on how much oxygen was in the blood leaving the heart. "I was young and made the argument at a national meeting," he said. "Everyone believed me. It was an exercise in pure logic, an exercise that was, at some level, unassailable." Locke reasoned that if the oxygen level in the blood pumped into the aorta was within normal range, then the left ventricle was sufficiently well-formed to receive oxygenated blood from the lungs and pump it out to the body. This showed that enough heart muscle existed to allow recovery after a wall repair. The high oxygen level, Locke also deduced, meant that there was no significant shunting of blood from the right ventricle, meaning the left ventricle was strong enough to keep pressures high on the left side of the heart. On the face of it, it was intellectually correct. It just happens to be wrong. It turned out that the oxygen content in the blood leaving the baby's heart could be nearly normal even when a significant amount of blood, some 20%, was shunted from the right ventricle. Impeccable logic, Locke said, doesn't always suffice. My mistake was that I reasoned from first principles when there was no prior experience. I turned out to be wrong because there are variables that you can't factor in until you actually do it. And you make the wrong recommendation, and the patient doesn't survive. I didn't leave enough room for what seems like minor effects, Locke elaborated, the small fluctuations in oxygen levels, which might amount to 1 or 2 or 3%, but actually can signal major problems in the heart. Locke recalled a second example of this type of mistake, of relying on strict logic to answer a clinical question in the absence of empirical data. I said there were patients with severe narrowing of the mitral valve who would always be better if the hole between the left and right atrium were closed. I reasoned that the body would get more blood if the hole was closed. You would get high enough pressure to fill the left ventricle through the narrowed mitral valve. To translate what Locke was saying, you want to maximize the pressure in the left atrium to force as much blood as possible through a narrowed mitral valve into the left ventricle, so the left ventricle can pump adequate amounts of blood out to the body. It has to be right, correct? Locke asked. I nodded in agreement. It is very sound logic, but it's wrong. After having surgery to close the hole, some children got sicker. This was ultimately found to result from an unexpected ripple effect. Even modest increases in pressure in the left atrium rippled back and caused higher pressure in the vessels of the lungs or pulmonary hypertension. The right heart, forced to pump against this higher pressure, weakened. These children developed right heart failure, and clinically they became worse, Locke said. Again, what seemed to be a rational approach resulted in harm. There are aspects to human biology and human physiology that you just can't predict. Deductive reasoning doesn't work for every case. Sherlock Holmes is a model detective, but human biology is not a theft or a murder where all the clues can add up neatly. Rather, in medicine, there is uncertainty that can make action against a presumed culprit misguided. Locke didn't immediately learn that it was a mistake to use logic alone. 25 years ago, when I asserted that oxygen levels should be sufficient to make the decision to repair or not repair a malformed wall between the left and right heart, and it didn't work out, I thought I should just have been smarter. His second mistake, though, about closing the hole between the left and right atrium, was more troubling to him. Locke averted his gaze, and his face fell. To be wrong about a child is a form of suffering unique to his profession. I learned that I need to be more circumspect about making these predictions. I have to be more clear to myself that even though the reasoning seems extremely tight, I am still making it up. And you absolutely have to recognize that what you think you know can have limitations. Physicians, like everyone else, display certain psychological characteristics when they act in the face of uncertainty. There is the overconfident mindset. People convince themselves they are right because they usually are. Also, they tend to focus on positive data rather than negative data. Positive data are emotionally more appealing, because they suggest a successful outcome. Apparently normal oxygen levels or higher pressures in the left atrium mean surgery will succeed. Locke's errors pivoted on the power of positive numbers. The near-normal amounts of oxygen in the blood, the high pressure in the left atrium. Each of these positive numbers seemed to predict a good outcome. Such data have a powerful effect on our psyche, particularly in settings of uncertainty. They appear to be safe harbors in a storm, places to firmly dock our minds and point us to the next leg of our journey. But biology, particularly human biology, is inherently variable. Those variations, at times very small and easily ignored, can prove important. They reflect significant differences that our most refined measurements fail to capture. Locke is also concerned that many physicians assume all numbers have equal certitude or validity. "People don't throw in specific gravity," Locke said, meaning that not all results should be given equal weight in making decisions. You learn which numbers to respect and which to discount. Specialists, in particular, are known to demonstrate unwarranted clinical certainty. They have trained for so long that they begin too easily to rely on their vast knowledge and overlook the variability in human biology. This is why Locke's epistemological focus is so important. He is constantly trawling his mind, reminding himself that the situation is uncertain, and acknowledging that necessary actions and decisions made with the best intentions may not apply to every patient. It is very difficult to do what Locke does, always to reflect rather than tacitly act on scant precedent. In their book, Professional Judgment, A Reader in Clinical Decision-Making, Jack Dowie and Arthur Elstein assemble articles from experts with contrasting opinions about physician cognition and how to improve it. Many of the contributors are from the Bayesian school of decision-making, invoking expected utility theory. This theory holds that the utility of a certain outcome is multiplied by its probability, and it determines the expected utility in the face of uncertainty. The calculation, based on axioms, has the doctor choose the path with the highest number emerging from the formula. Of course, much of what doctors like Locke deal with is unique. There is no set of published studies from which decision analysis researchers can derive a probability. Some experts contend that it is not only a unique case that makes a Bayesian approach untenable in many clinical settings. Donald A. Schon at MIT has written extensively about how professionals think, and he differs sharply from the decision analysis camp, which relies on applied mathematics to model diagnosis and treatment. Mathematics originally used to optimize submarine searching and bomb tracking, and that has been fostered by the advent of computers. The physician in the trenches, Schon emphasizes, faces divergent situations where relying on a large database to assign probabilities to a certain diagnosis or the outcome of a certain treatment completely breaks down. Locke sees himself as a rational thinker, a physician who looks to logic and makes deductions. But he also understands the limits of that logic, an understanding gained from hard experience. Schon could be describing Locke when he writes, "Because of some puzzling, troubling, interesting phenomena, a physician expresses uncertainty, takes the time to reflect, and allows himself to be vulnerable. Then he restructures the problem. This is the key to the art of dealing with situations of uncertainty, instability, uniqueness, and value conflict." Yet it is not only in Locke's world where the specter of uncertainty shadows decisions. David M. Eddy, a professor of health policy at Duke University, says, "Uncertainty creeps into medical practice through every pore. Whether a physician is defining a disease, making a diagnosis, selecting a procedure, observing outcomes, assessing probabilities, assigning preferences, or putting it all together, he is walking on very slippery terrain. It is difficult for non-physicians, and for many physicians, to appreciate how complex these tasks are, how poorly we understand them, and how easy it is for honest people to come to different conclusions. Jay Katz, a physician who teaches at Yale Law School, has examined the defenses that physicians deploy against awareness of uncertainty. He looks to the earlier work of René Fox, who identified three basic types of uncertainty. The first results from incomplete or imperfect mastery of available knowledge. No one can have at his command all skills and all knowledge of the lore of medicine. The second depends on limitations in current medical knowledge. There are innumerable questions to which no physician, however well trained, can provide answers. A third source of uncertainty derives from the first two. This is the difficulty in distinguishing between personal ignorance or ineptitude and the limitations of present medical knowledge. Fox observed physicians on a ward struggling with uncertainty, and their numerous psychological mechanisms to cope with it, including black humor, making bets about who would be right, and engaging in some degree of magical thinking to maintain their poise and an aura of competence in front of the patients while performing uncertain procedures. Katz lumps Fox's three categories together under the rubric disregard of uncertainty. He believes that when physicians shift from a theoretical discussion of medicine to its practical application, they do not acknowledge the uncertainty inherent in what they do. Katz argues that while uncertainty itself imposes a significant burden on physicians, the greater burden is the obligation to keep these uncertainties in mind and acknowledge them to patients. He observes that the denial of uncertainty, the proclivity to substitute certainty for uncertainty, is one of the most remarkable human psychological traits. It is both adaptive and maladaptive, and therefore both guides and misguides. As a law school professor, Katz knows that witnesses at scenes of accidents unwittingly fill in their incomplete perceptions and recollections with data. There is a pervasive and fateful human need to remain in control of one's internal and external worlds by seemingly understanding them, even at the expense of falsifying the data. Physicians' denial of awareness of uncertainty serves similar purposes. It makes matters seem clearer, more understandable, and more certain than they are. It makes action possible. There are limits to living with uncertainty. It can paralyze action. This is a core reality of the practice of medicine, where, in the absence of certitude, decisions must be made. Another defense against uncertainty is the culture of conformity and orthodoxy that begins in medical school. This is inherent in the apprentice process. For example, in Katz's first year at med school, the faculty of one distinguished university hospital taught his class that thinning the blood with anticoagulants like heparin or coumadin was the treatment of choice for a threatening pulmonary embolism, and that using any other therapy constituted unprofessional conduct. At another equally distinguished hospital, the students were told that the only correct treatment was surgically tying off the inflamed veins. One could use such an exposure to controversy as training for uncertainty. In neither setting, Katz recounts, was the divergent made a teaching exercise, nor were we encouraged to keep an open mind. In both, we were educated for dogmatic certainty, for adopting one school of thought or the other, and for playing the game according to the venerable but contradictory rules that each institution sought to impose on staff, students, and patients. Katz's observation, made two decades ago, still holds true. One would think that primary care physicians, such as general practitioners, internists, and pediatricians, grapple most with uncertainty. But Locke opens our eyes to the truth that specialization in medicine confers a false sense of certainty. Recall how Shira Stein was cared for by teams of specialists in one of the world's best pediatric hospitals. Yet a series of cognitive errors went unrecognized. Confirmation bias, the attention to data that support the presumed diagnosis and minimizing data that contradict it, was prominent. Specialists, like Shira's doctors in the previous chapter, are also susceptible to diagnosis momentum. Once an authoritative senior physician has fixed a label to the problem, it usually stays firmly attached, because the specialist is usually right. Specialization can persuade the expert that the treatments his fellow specialists prescribe are superior. For example, in the case of prostate cancer, surgeons, radiation therapists, and chemotherapists often disagree about the respective merits of their treatments, often without sufficiently doubting the effectiveness of their own approach. So a patient's chance first encounter with one specialist may guide that patient to choose the therapy of that discipline. But that is not a true choice. If, instead, the patient meets with several specialists and is informed of each approach without bias, he might choose another option. Ideally, as Locke said, we could perform large clinical trials to remedy the differences in opinion among specialists. This seems simple, but in fact ignores the complexity of human biology and patients' needs. Says David Eddy, "In theory, uncertainty could be managed if it were possible to conduct enough experiments under enough conditions and observe the outcomes. Unfortunately, measuring the outcomes of medical procedures is one of the most difficult problems we face. The goal is to predict the use of a procedure in a particular case and its effects on that patient's health and welfare. Standing in the way are at least a half dozen major obstacles. The central problem is that there is a natural variation in the way people respond to a medical procedure. Take two people who, to the best of our ability to find such things, are identical in all important respects. Submit them to the same operative procedure, and one will die on the operating table while the other will not. Because of this natural variation, we can only talk about the probabilities of various outcomes. The probability that a diagnostic test will be positive if the disease is present, sensitivity, the probability that a test would be negative if the disease is absent, specificity, the probability that a treatment will yield a certain result. An additional problem is that many procedures have multiple outcomes, and it is not sufficient to examine just one of them. For example, a coronary artery bypass may change the life expectancy of a 60-year-old man with triple vessel disease, but it will also change his joy of life for several weeks after the operation, the degree and severity of chest pain, his ability to walk and make love, his relationship with his son, the physical appearance of his chest and his pocketbook. Pain, disability, anxiety, family relations, and any number of other outcomes are all important consequences of a procedure that deserve consideration. But the list is too long for practical experiments, and many of the items on it are invisible or not measurable at all. Does acknowledging uncertainty undermine a patient's sense of hope and confidence in his physician and the proposed therapy? Paradoxically, taking uncertainty into account can enhance a physician's therapeutic effectiveness, because it demonstrates his honesty, his willingness to be more engaged with his patients, his commitment to the reality of the situation rather than resorting to evasion, half-truth, and even lies. And it makes it easier for the doctor to change course if the first strategy fails, to keep trying. Uncertainty sometimes is essential for success. Chapter 7. Surgery and Satisfaction. The human hand contains 27 bones and scores of ligaments, muscles, and tendons. Working in concert, these parts give us the ability to thread a needle, bow a cello, deliver a left hook, operate a jackhammer, and caress a lover. Dr. Terry Light of Loyola University is a hand surgeon. When I spoke with him in the autumn of 2005, he had just finished his tenure as president of the American Society for Surgery of the Hand and was about to assume the presidency of the American Orthopedic Association. But at the time, these honors paled next to the fact that Dr. Light had once served as the hand surgeon for the Chicago White Sox. I had no doubt on which side Light stood in the eternal debate about whether a team's pitching or hitting is more important. Pitching, of course. Baseball occupied only part of our conversation, because I took the opportunity to present a complex diagnostic dilemma to Dr. Light. The case of a patient with debilitating pain and swelling in his right hand. The hand he used to write, turn his door key, and perform the innumerable tasks that mark each of our days. Over the course of 3 years, the patient had consulted 6 hand surgeons and got 4 different opinions about what was wrong and what to do about it. I was that patient. The trouble with my hand can be traced to my never learning to type. My 5th-grade teacher told my parents that I was not college material and advised that I be tracked to a vocational school to learn a trade. Truth be told, I was not a model child, too eager to engage in mischief, paying little attention in class, looking at the clock and counting the minutes until recess. A psychologist today might fix the label of ADHD to me, but at the time my family concluded that mine was a classic case of spilkes, a Yiddish word meaning roughly ants in your pants. My parents would later reject the teacher's advice. But in 5th grade I spent afternoons in metal shop instead of typing class. There was no expectation that I would ever need to use a typewriter. 10 years ago I bought my first laptop and banged clumsily at the keyboard for many hours at a time. I soon developed a roaring case of tendonitis in my wrists. I rested, returned to the computer, and suffered repeated bouts of pain. After a year, I gave up and went back to writing by hand. But I was left with a persistent ache in my right wrist. Annoying, but not severe enough to require medical attention. Then, one day in the pool, a swimmer in the neighboring lane happened to fling his arm in a downward arc at the same moment my right arm moved up. He delivered a blow to my right wrist. I iced the bruised wrist, and after a week the pain went back to its usual dull ache. Some months later at the hospital, an elderly woman was making her way toward the elevator. I was already inside and saw the doors begin to close. Reflexively, I extended my right hand, but it was too late for the electric eye to respond. The elevator briefly closed on my wrist. Ice again treated the trauma. Dr. Light listened closely, not interrupting. I told him I was coming to the key event that caused me to consult the first surgeon. A few weeks after the elevator incident, I struggled to open the lid of a bottle of fruit juice. After much forceful twisting, I succeeded, but in a flash, excruciating pain erupted in my right wrist. The hand became hot, beet red, and swollen. I couldn't move it. I took some naproxen, an anti-inflammatory drug, and applied ice. After a few days, the swelling subsided. But each time I tried to write more than a few sentences, I developed sharp pain in my wrist below my thumb. I went for X-rays, which revealed cysts, essentially fluid-filled holes, within the scaphoid and lunate, 2 small bones on the thumb side of the wrist. The first hand surgeon I consulted I will call Dr. A. In his early 40s, A was known in the Boston medical community as the doctor for many professional athletes injured during play. His waiting room was jam-packed. Nearly 2 hours after my scheduled appointment, his nurse finally ushered me into an examining room. 5 rooms were already occupied by other patients, some with casts, others with pins, still others in slings. Dr. A entered some 30 minutes later, asking me where I worked and what kind of medicine I practiced. A name, rank, and serial number, bedside manner. As he listened to my story, he jotted a few notes. Dr. A examined my hand, and I winced when he pressed over the bones beneath the thumb. "Let's get some X-rays," he said. I said that I'd already had X-rays in my own hospital, but he insisted that I repeat them in his clinic. An hour later, he returned. The X-rays were as before. Dr. Ray told me that many people have cysts in their bones and show no symptoms. Other people have bone cysts and have symptoms from them. Some people have a hereditary disposition to cysts, while others develop cysts that are degenerative, the result of trauma or the wear and tear of work, sports, and daily living. Dr. Ray suggested that I be splinted for a month, and we would see what happened. At the end of 4 weeks, I was back in his clinic, waiting another 2 hours to be examined. I had used the splint diligently, but when I took it off to shower, I had pain in my wrist. Dr. A briefly examined my wrist and then told me to see how my wrist felt when I used it out of the splint over the coming weeks. The appointment ended in minutes. I gradually started doing things with my right hand. It was painful to hold even light objects, like a mug of coffee, but I persisted. And then one day, while writing a few sentences with a narrow pen, I felt my hand begin to heat up. Within minutes, it was swollen and red. I could not bend the wrist, and the smallest shift from a fixed neutral position was excruciating. It was like the episode with the juice bottle. I called Dr. A's office. His secretary instructed me to come in the next day. Dr. A looked at the hot, swollen hand and shook his head. "Let's get an MRI scan," he said. I asked what he thought was wrong. "I really don't know." In a strange way, I was reassured. Some doctors do not readily admit ignorance. The next week, Dr. A reviewed the results of the MRI scan with me. The scan was formatted digitally on his computer screen so he could enlarge it and zoom in on various parts. He led me through a tour of my hand. It was fascinating to visualize the connecting bones, ligaments, muscles, and tendons. The MRI showed the cysts in the scaphoid and lunate bones. Against the white background of bone, the cysts resembled craters on the moon. There was considerable swelling, with the rope-like tendons suspended in a sea of fluid. Dr. Ray still had no diagnosis, and suggested that I be splinted again. Later, when I reviewed my history with Dr. Terry Light, he agreed with Dr. A's approach. Better to say you're not sure and take the time to figure it out. Often we don't know what accounts for symptoms of pain in the hand, given that almost everyone has a hole in a bone if you look hard enough. The splint gave me temporary relief. But over the next few months, with the most minor activity, my hand would become swollen, red, and painful. I saw Dr. A at least 4 times over the course of the year. At each visit, I pressed him to try to figure out what was wrong. He wondered whether the hot, swollen wrist might represent some underlying systemic disease, like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, and whether the history of tendonitis from the computer and the trauma in the swimming pool and the elevator were red herrings. But all of my blood tests for systemic diseases that cause arthritis were negative. A steroid injection into the wrist was no help. At each follow-up visit, I pressed Dr. A for answers. He would just shrug. Then, a year after I first consulted him, he said, "I think you have developed a hyperreactive synovium." "The synovium, the lining of the joints around the wrist and hand," Dr. A explained, "had become too sensitive to endure even minor stresses. It overreacted by becoming inflamed." He suggested a surgical procedure to strip away all of it. I asked whether the synovium was essential for the joint to function properly, whether there might be scarring after the procedure. Dr. A allowed that the synovium was necessary, but eventually a new lining would grow back. And yes, there could be residual scar tissue. I am not a specialist in diseases of the bones and joints, and I'd never heard of a hyperreactive synovium. Neither had Dr. Light. He said that the diagnosis didn't register. It doesn't really mean anything to me. Dr. A had come to the end of his thinking. But instead of returning to the honesty of, "I really don't know," he invented something to respond to my plaintive questioning and suggested an operation that could be damaging. It was time to seek another opinion. I went to a neighboring state to see Dr. B. He was prompt, had a focused, deliberate approach, examined me carefully, and agreed that hyperreactive synovium was not a real clinical condition. He said he was determined to find out what was wrong and fix it. Dr. B. studied in detail every unusual shadow and shape on my X-rays and MRI scan. In addition to the cysts in the scaphoid and lunate bones, he noted a tiny cyst in another bone, on the pinky side of the wrist. The tendon that runs toward the pinky also seemed to have slipped slightly out of position. Dr. B. thought there was a hairline fracture in the scaphoid bone, not simply a cyst. He said that I needed 3 surgeries. The first would pin the fracture. The second would involve draining the 3 cysts and filling each with bone grafts taken from my hip. And the third would reposition the displaced tendon. "The wrist works like a set of gears," he said. "When one or more of the components is out of alignment or malfunctioning, then you can get stuck all across the hand. My straining to shift the stuck gears caused the swelling and pain." I asked Dr. B. how long the recovery period would be from 3 sequential operations. 18 to 24 months, he said. Dr. Terry Light said, of course, that to comment properly on Dr. B.'s opinion, he would have had to examine me and view the MRI. But the idea of 3 surgeries to address every finding on the scan, this gave